Time, smartly done, Tony. Welcome, truth seekers, to the Mike Malloy program. It is I, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, here with you again, broadcasting live from Los Angeles at the studios of lovely K-Talk AM 1150 in the middle of beautiful downtown Burbank. Thank you, Tony. Smartly done. We're glad to have you all with us today. We're here all week long as the Malloys are off on a well-deserved vacation down in the Sunshine State. But never fear, truth seekers, we'll make it up to you. We got a hell of a show ahead and a hell of a week ahead. Coming up on today's show, Andy Worthington, journalist, historian, and author of, well, he's the guy who wrote the book on Guantanamo, the Guantanamo Files. He's going to be joining us very shortly, so if you have any questions about Guantanamo and what the hell is going on down there, what the hell's not supposed to be going on down there, anything else, feel free to give us a call. We'll try to get you on this hour with Andy Worthington. Our number is 877-520-1150. That's different than Mike's normal number, so don't call the Malloys. Call us this week only, 877-520-1150. We'd love to hear from you. Also coming up today, Mr. Grant. Desi, can you do a Mary impression? Can you do a Mr. Grant sort of thing?
Mr. Grant.
That was pathetic. That was the worst. Yeah.
You just do, oh, Rob.
There you go.
That's better, but that's a different show.
How's that? Ed Asner is going to be joining us a little bit later in this show. And you're going to want to stick with us. He is the star, aside from being Mr. Grant, the star of the smash Pixar film Up, which, if you have not seen Up, please do. It is just beautiful, and I hardly need to convince anybody to go see that movie because everybody's going to see it. But it's really a beautiful film, particularly beautiful in 3D, I might add. So Ed Asner is going to be with us. Desi, you just heard Desi Doyen, my producer. She's going to be back a little bit later with the Green News Report. She's my co-host on the Green News Report. If you're not familiar with that, you can check that out at greennews.bradblog.com. If you're not familiar with it, shame on you and shame on your radio station for not carrying it, because we would love to be on your affiliate station. 6 minutes of the most smashing, scintillating green news radio in the green news radio business. We're going to have that a little bit later. Plus, your calls for Desi. You actually get to talk back this time to Desi. And tomorrow, I want to add Sibel Edmonds is going to be with us, the FBI whistleblower. Wake the neighbors, spread the kids. Wait, what? I don't know. Sibel Edmonds is going to be joining us tomorrow, taking your calls. If you don't know who she is, go Google her. It's an extraordinary story that she has to tell. But we're going to be talking about not just her FBI whistleblowing and what she's not allowed to tell. She is, after all, the most gagged woman in America, according to the ACLU. So who knows what she'll disclose illegally and if she'll get thrown in jail before the hour is out. We're going to talk not only about that stuff with her, but also her new project, Project Expose MSM. Yeah. All right. Well, before we get to Andy Worthington here and your calls for Andy, a couple of items. We talked yesterday about this this insane story. Governor Sanford of South Carolina disappeared 6 days ago. Didn't tell his wife where the hell he was going. He missed Father's Day, by the way. He's got four sons, I believe. He was gone. He hadn't talked to his wife. She had no idea where he is. It's an amazing story. Well, we've got an update that we're supposed to believe. And this comes this morning from ABC's Jake Tapper. He says that, Tapper twittered this morning that Governor Sanford has now made contact with his office. Here's the Twitter. Gov Sanford called office and was, quote, taken aback when learning of interest his trip has garnered, his spokes says. Will return to office tomorrow. Of course, what's notable here is that while the spokespeople, spokespersons for Governor Sanford had been working overtime to make it seem like everything was just fine. There's nothing to worry about here. These aren't the droids you're looking for. Well, as it turns out, it doesn't actually seem like anybody has talked to the governor. So whether they're putting out an effective cover story to make everybody feel like everything is just fine is hard to say. Apparently there was enough concern that they bothered to track his cell phone to figure out where they were able to last pick it up. They last picked it up in Atlanta last week, as I believe AP reported. A mobile telephone tower there picked up a signal from his phone, according to a source familiar with the situation. Well, if there's no problem, why are they going to the phone company and figuring out where his cell phone last pinged? The paper goes on to say, this is South Carolina's The State newspaper, says that since then, the governor's state and personal phones had been turned off, and Sanford had not responded to phone or text messages, a source said. Most mobile phones cannot be tracked if they are turned off. Most mobile phones cannot be. I didn't notice that when I read the story the first time. Hello, NSA! I've got my phone turned off, but they know where I am. I've got nothing to hide. Speaking of something to hide, Adam Fogel, writing for Palmetto Scoop, seems to have found something that perhaps Sanford did want to hide. Well, I'll let him tell it here. He asks, quote, why would a sitting governor just up and disappear to the mountains without telling a single soul, including his family? Well, the Palmetto Scoop may have discovered the answer to all the secrecy. The governor may have gone for a naked hike, Fogel writes. Yeah. No, really, he says. Fogel then points to an AP article which reported that every year on the first day of summer, a few outdoor enthusiasts nationwide expose virtually all of themselves to insects, scrapes, and thorns for the pleasure of bonding with nature au naturel. They call it Naked Hiking Day. This year, the summer solstice falls on a weekday, on a weekend, this Sunday, Father's Day. Fogel asks, could it be that Sanford just wanted to go au naturel in the middle of the woods and was too embarrassed to tell anyone? Or perhaps he was one of the nudist hikers arrested by police and they had to work out a deal to quietly get him released just to help spread that scandalous rumor. Of course, I'm not the only one spreading that scandalous rumor. MSNBC was, too. So if they can do it, I can do it. Yeah, that's so they're reporting that his office is reporting that everything's fine. He's on the Appalachian Trail hiking. Naked. All right. They didn't say that part, but I said that part. Now, just before we went in the air here, Des, who I'm going to call you back into service here again, you said there is additional news now.
Yeah, I just saw this, and I'm waiting for the I'm looking to get more information. But the first indications are NBC Atlanta has a scoop that a state vehicle was reported as missing, and that was one of the reasons that they were saying he had checked out a state vehicle. This state vehicle was found not at the Appalachian Trail, but at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport in Atlanta. So the sources that this reporter at NBC Atlanta talked with said that a federal agent had spotted Governor Sanford at the airport getting on a plane, but that he was not accompanied by a security.
And flying to where? Yeah, right. He took no security detail. They said this is not unusual for him to go off the grid without security detail, except not overnight. And the first time he's done this overnight, and this is for six nights. And of course, I'm laughing, and you know, something horrible could have happened to him. So
right,
we are glad
to hear that he has checked in and that he's fine.
I don't know if he has checked in.
I thought you said.
Well, that's what Jake Tapper reported that Sanford's office has said. So if you believe his spokespersons who are trying to put a lid on this story, in fact, the lieutenant governor is none too happy about it. Apparently, he was rebuffed by the governor's staff when he tried to find out where Sanford was and had not been put in charge in his absence. This is Lieutenant Governor Andrew Bauer. He said, I cannot take lightly that his staff has not had communication with him for more than 4 days. This was 2 days ago when he said this. And that no one, including his own family, knows his whereabouts. This is the lieutenant governor. Okay, and just in case, Mark Sanford, by the way, is a
Republican, hopeful.
He's a hopeful, that's right, for 2012 for the presidential race, or at least he was before this nonsense. Who wants your president sort of disappearing for 6 days? But just in case you think this is a Democratic thing, they're out to get him. This is what Senator Jake Knotts, a Lexington Republican, had to say about Sanford. Now, Knotts has been a critic of Sanford, but he says that the state needs to know where the governor is. The way things are in the world today and Homeland Security, we need the governor to be fingertips away. Yeah, I think so. So anyway, it's not just the Democrats. It's also the Republicans who are complaining about this guy just up and disappearing. And maybe everything's fine. Maybe he's hiking on the Appalachian Trail, naked. Or maybe, but who knows? He says he's going to check into the office tomorrow. I suspect people will be paying attention. All right, presuming he's all right, that story doesn't actually matter. But it is kind of funny.
Yeah.
Because maybe he's hiking naked on the Appalachian Trail, which goes through something like 12 or 14 different states. None of them are South Carolina. And, by the way, the protection of that Appalachian state, paid for by federal money. The Appalachian Trail, paid for by federal money. The same federal money that Sanford didn't want, remember, from the stimulus bill, that he was very upset because they made him take the money.
His own state legislature made him take the money, not the federal government.
That's right. That's right. His own state legislature. And then they went to court. He then went to court. The Supreme Court said, no, you got to take the money, you idiot. All right. Well, we're going to come back with something a bit more serious, but I think you will still enjoy it. We're going to come back with Andy Worthington, historian and journalist, to talk about Gitmo and what the hell is going on down there. Brad Friedman in for Malloy all this week. Oh, we'll take your calls, too. I got to give the number out because it's a different one. 877-520-1150. You can also stop by bradblog.com. We have an open thread at the top of the blog. The lovely Agent 99 will be nice to you. Give us a call. 877-520-1150. Andy Worthington up next. All right, welcome back to the Malloy Program. Brad Friedman of Brad Blog in for Malloy all week. We're going to move from naked governor to, oh, man, naked prisoners at Guantanamo. Sorry. Joining me now and taking your calls at 877-520-1150. If you have any questions about what the hell's going on down at Guantanamo, this is the guy who literally wrote the book on Guantanamo. Andy Worthington joins me. He is the freelance journalist and historian and a regular contributor to the to the UK's Guardian, the Daily Star Lebanon, the Huffington Post, antiwar.com, Counterpunch, and Alternet. He's also the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 759 detainees in America's illegal prison. And he's staying up very late for us tonight. We're doing a little sleep deprivation on him. How are you, Andy? Welcome to the show.
That's very good, Brad. It is a bit like sleep deprivation. It's very late here, but I'm all right.
And I really appreciate you staying up late for me tonight, because really, you are the guy, you are the source. When I have a question about Guantanamo, when there's a story breaking on Guantanamo, you've got the scoop. You've got the real details. For example, on this Alibi fellow who was found reportedly committed suicide a few weeks ago. He was the link that the Bush administration offered between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, and that link came under torture. We're going to talk about him in a little bit and about that suicide. But first, the title of your book, Andy, The Guantanamo Files, the Stories of the 759 Detainees in America's Illegal Prison. Illegal prison? What's so illegal about it?
Well, you know, there's only really two ways that you put somebody in captivity. One is that they're a prisoner of war and they're treated according to the Geneva Conventions. And the other is that you hold them as a criminal suspect and put them forward for a trial. The Bush administration came up with a third way, enemy combatants who could be held without charge or trial if that's what the administration desired. And if they wanted, they could put them forward for special military trials, special terror courts, the military commissions. You know, and that's the mess that we're all left with. Mess is actually the word that Barack Obama used in a speech a couple of months ago to describe his frustration with what he was dealing with. But that's it, really. I mean, there is no third way in which you deal with prisoners.
And it's not the prison itself, then, is not illegal. It is what is going on and the way they're operating it. Would that be more accurate way to describe it?
Well, I'm not sure that it's ever been, you know, really cleared up as to you know, why it is where it is and what that means. I mean, it was specifically chosen cynically by the administration because they thought that the U.S. courts wouldn't be able to have any oversight of Guantanamo because technically it belongs to Cuba, even though the U.S. Holds sovereignty over it, or, you know, is in charge of it. And in fact, they got away with that for 2.5 years until the Supreme Court said, look, you're holding these guys without any rights whatsoever. You never screened them properly. We actually are going to say to you that that the U.S. law does apply there. And because you have held them without any rights whatsoever, we're going to do something quite unusual for prisoners in wartime. We're going to give them habeas corpus rights, and we want them to come to courts and be able to explain why you're holding them. And of course, that was the summer of 2004. That was 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It took another 4 years for the Supreme Court to have to come back and say the same thing again, because in the meantime, politicians were prevailed upon to change the law and to deprive them of these rights.
And there was really no cleanup between the time that Supreme Court decision was made and the time Barack Obama came in. I mean, my understanding is he just walked into the mess you described. It was an absolute mess. Records were missing for these folks. They were all over the place. What records there were. Is that an accurate description of what he found when he took over in January?
I think that is an accurate description, yeah, and I think it's kind of still the problem, and I think that they've, to some extent, have tried to find these kind of elusive extra bits of evidence. You know, they came across the files, and they looked at them and went, what is that it? And the truth is that in most cases, that's it.
Hang on, hold the thought, Andy. I got to get to a break here. We're going to come back with plenty more with Andy Worthington and your calls, 877-520-1150. Brad Friedman in for Malloy. Stay with us.
I was born, six gun in my hand.
All right, welcome back. Friedman in for Malloy. You're listening to the Malloy program. Malloy's on vacation. I'm not. Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, speaking with Andy Worthington, a journalist and historian and the author of The Guantanamo Files, the story of 759 detainees in America's illegal prisons. You can give us a call, 877-520-1150, 877-520-1150. And there we go. I got it back. Andy, who joins us, by the way, from, are you in London? Am I right?
Hi, I'm in London. Yes.
Actually, in London, in the middle of the night. God bless you, sir. We were talking about Barack Obama and the mess he inherited when he walked in, and I've got some criticism for him, but before I get to that criticism, the files we had, how many hundreds of prisoners were there when he took over, when Obama took over in January?
There were 240-something.
And most of them had already been released. Am I correct? Is the majority of folks who were released, I'm sorry, the majority of folks who were captured turned out to be completely innocent and they were released?
Yeah, they were either completely innocent. I mean, that's the case with hundreds of men. Or in the case of hundreds of other men, they had gone to Afghanistan long before the 9/11 attacks to help the Taliban fight their enemies in Afghanistan in an inter-Muslim civil war, the Northern Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, as soon as 9/11 happened and after that the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan, then they instantly became enemies of the United States. But for the most part, these guys hadn't gone out to fight the United States. They'd gone out to fight Afghans, other Muslims.
And so this whole worst of the worst business, these guys are the worst of the worst. It turns out most of them weren't worst at all. Some of them had nothing to do with terrorism whatsoever. And when Obama came in then, they found that what? The files were all over the place. The information about these guys was it just messy, or did it not exist? Were we holding people that we just had no information on at all?
Well, I don't think there's a lot of information on a lot of the guys, actually, Brad, to be honest. I mean, you know, the majority of the information has come from the interrogations of other prisoners. Well, we know that, you know, if torture wasn't used, then other forms of coercion were used. We know that there are certain prisoners who have been bribed to provide information, you know, better conditions, who've gone for that. People with mental health issues have been coming up with stories against other prisoners. This doesn't really count as evidence. I think a big problem has been that it's been extremely difficult to get information from certain intelligence agencies. But, you know, again, this, part of this problem is, do they really have anything or not? So, a terrible mess in a way that he took over. But I think that they've dithered a lot, and that they really should have had enough background information to say, well, look, most of these guys don't need to be here. You know, this was a colossal mistake on the part of the previous administration, and I think they haven't made that clear enough.
No, they haven't, and the Democrats have sadly fallen for so much of this. Oh, we don't want to. We can't give the money to close down Gitmo because, my God, these worst of the worst, they'll come into the United States and somehow they will escape while they're being transported. I mean, we keep already the worst of the worst, the real worst of the worst, in our supermax prisons. And this notion that we're unable to, keep these guys locked up is laughable, not to mention, hey, some of them are innocent and some of them, sorry, but they may have to be freed even if they do pose a danger. And many of them, am I correct to presume here that many of them may not have posed a danger before, but after being held without charges for 6, 7, 8 years, maybe they're a little ticked off right now at the U.S. and maybe they do pose a danger that we created?
Well, I think that may be the case. There may be some of the people who are held who've been, radicalized by what's happened to them. It's not my experience from looking at the stories of the majority of the people who've been released from Guantanamo. I don't think that it's very easy to kind of create a terrorist out of nowhere, if you like. I think what we really need to get down to is that there's a few dozen, maybe three dozen, genuinely dangerous people in Guantanamo, and the rest we should be looking at how to get rid of, how to send them home or find another place for them. Now, the dangerous guys that we're talking about, and I agree with you, you know, what's so scary about a country that has the most efficient maximum security prison set up in the world? Why are these guys somehow exceptional? They're not. You know, they've been held safely for 7 years in Guantanamo. They were transported there without any problem. Take them to the mainland, sort out the trials they're going to have. End of story. Let's get this horrible, long-running saga to an end. Really.
I concur. Let me take a quick call, and then I want to ask you about Al Libby. Tim calling in from Detroit. Hey, Tim, welcome to the Molloy Show. How are you, sir?
Pretty well. I think Mr. Worthen didn't answer my question, but I'll still ask it. In his research that he's done on the Guantanamo detainees, has he found that probably the ones held now are most of them innocent of any sorts of acts of, as we define it, terrorism?
Well, you know, I don't know what the exact figures are, I would say that there's a few dozen people there that are dangerous enough to be put on trial. You know, I mean, we know that they include people who have claimed involvement in the 9/11 attacks and various other terror attacks, and there are some other people. But all the figures that have come out over the years, I mean, recently, Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff, said that, you know, all the information that he'd been presented with when he was in a position to be hearing about this were that there were no more than two dozen prisoners there who had any serious intelligence value. And over the years, stories that have come out from CIA operatives and from various people inside the administration who've spoken about it have mentioned these same kind of figures, two dozen to three dozen people who are significant in any way and in any way connected to terrorism.
Does that answer your question, Tim?
Could I have a follow-up question?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, regarding even those who are suspected of any terrorist acts or crimes, due to the torture that they've undoubtedly received, wouldn't any evidence now in any new trials be considered a fruit of the poisonous tree?
Well, yes, in theory, I think that that's absolutely right. And I would, you know, I would very, very much hope that in future there won't be cases where somebody's got to be put on trial and these kind of things will arise. But, you know, my way of looking at it is, if there is genuine evidence against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed that he was the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, I can't see that there's a jury anywhere in the United States that's actually going to care when it comes down to it in a courtroom what happened to him. They are going to convict him. You know, this is how I think it will work.
Sounds like vigilante justice, actually, but...
Sorry, what's that?
That sounds like vigilante justice, American style.
Well, I don't think so. I think that if genuine evidence can be provided, evidence that wasn't obtained through torture, then, you know, then sadly everybody will reach the conclusion that they're going to overlook the other things that happened to them. I can't see that people will be released because that happened if they genuinely were involved in these terrorist attacks.
Thanks for your call, Tim. On the issue of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, how certain are you that the information we've obtained from him was not under torture is actually accurate? Because I know, you know, a lot of the 9/11 truth folks out there, they don't buy into this KSM thing at all. Where do you fall on this? Do we have good information, or did this all come under torture?
Well, I mean, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib bragged about their involvement in the 9/11 attacks to an Al Jazeera reporter before they were captured by U.S. forces. You know, it seems to me that on that basis, really everything that happened afterwards was extremely counterproductive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you follow the story of Ramzi Youssef, who's the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and the whole involvement in the attacks on the Twin Towers in 1993 that Youssef did, the plans to blow up airplanes, the plans to use airplanes as bombs, I think there's a long story of that, and that probably makes sense. I hesitate to prejudge absolutely, because I think even after everything that's happened, this should be sorted out in a courtroom if at all possible. But, you know, I would say that that's the case. It looks that way. But, you know, we're talking about a handful of people, and, you know, out of nearly 800 who were held in Guantanamo and out of the many thousands who've been held elsewhere.
We're speaking with Andy Worthington, author of the Guantanamo Files. I almost called it the Gitmo Files, close enough. The story of the 759 detainees in America's illegal prison. When it comes to putting these guys on trial, guys like KSM and so forth, which Obama has said, essentially, given three options. One, these guys are going to be released because they're innocent, like the Uyghurs we saw recently released. They're going to be put on trial in a courtroom, or they're going to be given, well, actually, there's four options. They're going to be given a military tribunal, or in some cases, held indefinitely without charges, essentially when the government can't make his case. Is the government here, including Barack Obama, not trying to have it all ways? In other words, if they can't get a conviction, then they're not going to put him on trial of any sort.
Well, they are trying to have it every way possible, it seems, yeah. And, you know, I've got a problem, really, that they've moved a guy who they say was involved in the African embassy bombings in 1998 to New York, where he's facing a trial. Now, they've said that they might not do the same with some of the other guys, maybe the ones involved in 9/11. Now, that's obviously caution on their part, where they think, either because of the torture that took place or because there are some fears that they have about not securing a conviction, then they're not going to go ahead. Well, I don't think that it's really legitimate to have two systems, one which is the established federal court system and the other which is the military commissions, which were revived by Dick Cheney and have had a terrible and inglorious history for 7 years,
mm-hmm.
With only three dubious results. And, you know, almost every time that they convened, they were a mockery. But if they were to go ahead, they would undoubtedly be full of holes again, would be caught up in all kinds of problems that haven't yet been foreseen.
Do you have any confidence then in Obama's plan as far as the changes he's making to these military tribunals? Are they going to have any better results? Or are we going to be forced once again to just leave these guys to rot for years on end?
Well, I still think they won't be fair. I mean, you know, I just do think that it would make much more sense to just say, look, we're going to get this down to the smallest number of genuinely dangerous people. We're going to go for the court trials. As I say, I mean, I honestly think any genuine evidence is produced, there's no way a U.S. jury is gonna let these guys go. The other thing, though, that you mentioned, which is preventive detention, which, as far as I see the way it's been proposed, is that this wouldn't apply to these highest value prisoners. It would apply to people that they suspect of militancy, presumably the kind of militancy that tends to terrorism. So actually, slightly lesser characters in this whole scene. These must be the guys at the fringes of the numbers I've been talking about, maybe the third of the dozen of these prisoners. You know, they obviously think there are more than that because they've been bandying around figures of between 50 and 100. Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, if these guys aren't really considered that dangerous, why are we making exceptions for them that say, you know, you're either guilty or you're innocent as a result of a court case? We're inventing a new category of prisoner who we can hold. And, we start with suspected terrorists. Who do we go on to next? You know, we have in your country, you've lived for over 200 years with the laws as they stand, that if you suspect somebody of something, you put them on trial. If the trial fails for whatever reason, well, then that guy goes free. That's how it works.
Yeah.
You know, it honestly terrifies me, the thinking of inventing a new category of holding people and doing it humanely and according to the law and reviewing it. It's like, no, I don't think you've kind of got this, really.
Yeah, and
if you haven't got a case, sorry, you know.
I know, and I'm afraid that's what they're going to do. That's what Dick Cheney and George Bush did, and it seems to me that Obama is doubling down on that idea that we can do that. We're speaking with Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files. We're going to take your calls when we come back. 877-520-1150. Don't use Mike Malloy's normal number. He ain't going to get it. 877-520-1150 if you have any questions. And we're going to find out what came of Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, if I pronounce that right, right after this. Brad, in for Malloy. London calling. That's for you, Andy. Staying up late in the middle of the night for us out there in London. Andy Worthington, journalist, historian, author of The Guantanamo Files. Much appreciated, sir. I want to get, we got a bunch of calls here. So very quickly, on this story of Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, and am I pronouncing it close to correctly there, by the way?
I think that sounds about right to me, actually.
Thank you. For Yankee, not bad. So he's one of these guys who, one of these ghost detainees, suddenly he kind of goes missing after 2006, right?
Yeah.
And shows up, he shows up a week before he then turns up dead in a Libyan prison, and a supposed suicide. Now, he was the guy who, under torture, supposedly provided the link between Iraq and al-Qaeda, the link that was completely phony, wasn't made, you know, didn't exist after he'd been, essentially buried alive in a box for 12 hours or something and told them anything they wanted to know. Bush Cheney used that then when they wanted to go to war. Was he the only guy that they had, the only information that they had, phony information as it was, that tied Iraq to al-Qaeda at the time?
It was the main one. I mean, I heard more recently that they pushed Abu Zubaydah for similar information as well. You know, and on both bases, I think it was kind of rather stupid. I mean, there's a veteran FBI agent who said, you know, well, al-Libi ran an Afghan training camp. Why the hell would he know anything about Iraq? You know, and this is one of the guys who had al-Libi and had started talking to al-Libi and was getting al-Libi to cooperate without torturing him for that short period of time, a couple of weeks, I think, before the CIA put him in the box and sent him to Egypt. You know, these FBI guys, you know, not only were they skilled in interrogation, but I think they knew exactly what they were looking at. And the story was really built up that the training camp that al-Libi and Zubaydah were involved in was connected to Al-Qaeda, and whereas in fact it wasn't.
And is there any more information? He was supposedly, it was a suicide. Do we have any information to confirm or deny that? Very quickly, too, because I want to get to calls and we're almost out of time.
Sure. Well, I mean, the Libyan insiders say that, you know, this is a regular occurrence with Gaddafi, that people commit suicide when it's found out, when the bodies are delivered, that, you know, they've miraculously shot themselves in the back of the head. It doesn't seem likely at all. The timing of it is weird. You know, Human Rights Watch researchers had been to the prison just before he died, so maybe the Libyan government thought he was getting a bit too close. But I must admit, I was suspicious because the U.S. flag was raised in the embassy in Tripoli for the first time in over 30 years, just a few days after he died. It all seemed a bit convenient.
For what reason was the U.S. flag raised?
Oh, well, you know, to really solidify the bonds of friendship between both countries, closer than ever.
Just out of the blue, they raised this flag?
Yeah, 3 days after our Libby died.
Wow, that's bizarre. Milton, Florida, Dan, you're on the Mike Malloy Show. Very quickly for Andy Worthington. Oh, Dan in Florida?
Yes, this is Dan. How are you doing tonight?
Good. What's up?
Okay, basically, I just have to disagree with you a little bit on, it's with both Bush and Obama. We're kind of, I think, mixing up concept of operations and implementation here. You know, we're talking, you know, you're on a battlefield and, you know, people are dying left and right, your side and their side. You have people left over, you take them as prisoner. On the battlefield, you know, you have to take people. Where would you suggest that we take them?
Okay, where would you suggest? Thanks for that call, Dan.
I got more.
I know, but we're running out of... Actually, Andy, can you stay over the top of the hour? I know it's a god-awful hour out there, but I got some good calls. I'd love you to stick around, if you can stick around for 15 more minutes.
No, I can do that. I mean, may I answer this question?
Yeah, please do. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the key element is that, you know, I'm not saying by any means that war isn't a difficult business when it's being fought and that all kinds of problems arise and what do you do with prisoners. The key thing that I think people need to understand that didn't happen, specifically on the instructions of Cheney and others high up in the chain of command, was that every war since Vietnam, the U.S. military had held what are called competent tribunals. They take place very close to the place and time of capture of prisoners.
Andy, I got to take a hard break. Stick around. More Andy Worthington after the top of the hour. You're listening to The Mike Malloy Show.